Welcoming in writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, is brilliant and is available everywhere. Get it if you haven't already. If you have, get a copy for a friend, and you know they'll like you even more, I would say. Good afternoon, Mr. Fleming.
How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing fine. We're getting a little rain here, not as much as we need, but every little bit helps. It's been a dry season so far.
Do you have on your oil skin like a nautical man out there on the quarterdeck? I know I like to picture you.
Yeah.
A little bit like the Gordon's fisherman, but Kimball style.
Yes, standing at the helm. I don't know, is that the front? Standing somewhere on the ship looking weathered and yet happy with the decisions I've made in my life.
Is that the front? Well, I don't know that you're exactly seaworthy there, Mr. Kimball, so maybe some time down below sweeping the deck would benefit you, but my, is that the front? You're a Mainer.
I am, and yet the only reason I know that the port side is the left side of the ship is because when I grew up, left-handed pitchers were called portsiders.
That's pretty old school right there.
Yes.
I know someone who, when he needs a bit of information, he texts me, and it's like some pretty random things, and sometimes they're often disturbing things. But he texted me one time, and he said, do you know what port is? What's port? Should I have port? And I knew he was out at some like sort of fancy dinner type of thing. I said, yeah, it's like cough syrup. And it's all soupy. You'll enjoy it. So port ciders and Bruce Hurst and Kimball and my friend Hardwood John, interesting stuff.
Here we go. Well, we want to begin our discussion this afternoon. We've got much ground to cover, as always, but with a classic film from a 1957 that you rewatched recently, 12 Angry Men. I laughed when I saw the message because a teacher next door to me at school showed this movie to his students toward the end of the year as they were discussing the court system. And of course, it was black and white. And so, unfortunately, some members of this younger generation are instantly troubled when something's black and white. But I thought it was entertaining and informative that a couple of them said, why is everybody on the jury a man? How times have changed.
Is that how it works? People see black and white and it's just like this turnoff to them? That's interesting.
It is, unless they have been someone who's grown up in a house where they're exposed to those things earlier. I mean, even I know people in their 20s and 30s who will see black and white and go, oh, God, here we go. Me, I see black and white and I settle in because that's my comfort food.
It's just a strange thing to object to, though, because it doesn't really indicate anything that you're going to see. It doesn't indicate that there's going to be an absence of action or drama or anything like that. So that's curious. And I thought about you when I was watching this because I figured this is one of those works where inevitably you're well-versed in it. It's probably like Our Town with your background, not just liking films, but your background in like theater and working with kids and stuff. And I was thinking actually about how this would be viewed right now, how it would work out well for kids in high school, because a lot of the themes of this film, I think, work well with what's happening now, but maybe not the themes that one associates with the film. And so, for instance, you have the idea of the faulty witness who is stepping forward to have her belle of the ball type of moment in the courtroom. We don't see it. We're told about it later. And it's her big day to have some attention. And so she lies. And she doesn't even really necessarily know that she's lying. She just wants to sort of get the most attention on her as possible and store it up like an attention camel, because she's not going to have it for a while. And I thought that was something that would really connect with young people, because you should be looking around the classroom thinking, yep, he does that, she does that, he sucks because he does that. And so that was something that really stood out to me.
And I thought it was very interesting too, and it made me want to go back and watch it again, when you talked about the role the weather plays.
The weather is crucial in this film, because and also, I think Orson Welles could have done a great job directing this, because you have to be careful as the director not to make this too sedentary, too theater-esque. You have to make it a film. And so you have to find a way to animate this. It's really like a stage, like when you go to the theater. You have to find a way to animate it cinematically. So you have to create movement, and a lot of the sound is what we call diegetic sound. So that means that there's not going to be like the dun, 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 like in Cycle, you're not going to get the strings. There's not going to be that kind of like orchestration. The sound is going to be natural. And diegetic sound can take all kinds of forms. Someone can go into a bar and put on the Beatles' I Feel Fine on the jukebox, and that's technically like diegetic sound. That's not written for that film. So one of the sounds of this film, you have things like the fans and the wadded up paper bouncing off the fans and like a pen being put down. And the weather itself is a kind of percussive soundtrack when they eventually get to that point. We're pretty far along by then, but what I think is also interesting too is that you're sort of being cheated with this film. It's lying to you itself a few different ways over, because it's happening almost in real time. And yet this is something that would be carried out over days. They're knocking this bad boy out, this determination of a life and death and all that, in like 80 minutes of real time. And they're grumpy. It is taking them an hour and a half.
Yeah, they were very angry men to begin with. And then being cooped up in that room for all of an hour plus is too much for them. I love the work, and you mentioned it too, of Martin Balsam, who's great in everything, but is terrific as the foreman. But the interesting story that he tells.
Yes, he does. He's a fallible foreman, because it's funny that you have this job. So you're like the boss. And, well, probably like a lot of bosses, you didn't earn this job, but you have this sort of like pseudo power over people in that you get to call the votes and you're sort of responsible for organizing everything. And he has this conversation with Henry Fonda's character, which we should touch on too, because I don't think Henry Fonda is the hero that people associate him as with this film. But it's during the weather and they're all just standing in pot and they're at the window. These two characters, the foreman, who has had these moments too where he's like, you don't respect me enough as the foreman, you do the job. So he's not like this sort of like Iron Man character of foreman. He's faltering at certain points. So he starts telling the Henry Fonda character this story about the weather itself. He's a high school football coach, like assistant coach. So it's not like the big cheese. And their halfback, back when you had halfbacks and port siders, the halfback was doing his thing and running through the line because he never threw the ball but three times a season. And the halfback is slowed down by the rain. So he's sort of just bogged down in the mud. And the story doesn't go anywhere. And it just trails off. And Henry Fonda is listening. And the director, Sidney Lumet, he has the confidence to say, okay, that's enough. Because think of how many times people go and they tell you a story. And like, you, in one sense, want them to get to the end because the story is horrible. But then it doesn't even have an end. It just kind of like peters out. That's how people talk to each other. So that's what you're getting here with this. And don't forget, when they're all wrapped up and they've determined the life and the death and all of that, they go outside. It's still light out. It's not even dark. So this, like, the time is, again, like I said, a cheat. It plays with you. It tricks you. Because if this was actually like how the justice system worked, you wouldn't just be in and out like that, where you can say goodbye on the well-lit street afterwards with the two sort of like the so-called good guys of the film.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. From 12 Angry Men to a musical moment from the film Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, an odd pairing between Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe on a song called Two Little Girls from Little Rock, where we learn musically that men are the same everywhere, Colin.
Do you like that song?
I do like that song. It's so odd, but it somehow works in that film, in that time.
I think it works great now. I think it's actually one of my, I don't know like what the number is, but it's one of my favorite all-time songs. I love that song, and it's, if people want to go out there and check it out, you're going to have it in your head for a long time, and I think it's just one of those songs that's so well-written. It's a duet, but it's like a conversation too. And in this film, this Howard Hawks film, the Marilyn Monroe character, it's really her best role, I think. She is looking for what we now call a sugar daddy. So like some suave guy like yourself, Kimball, like your doppelganger who's out there And he's like, hey, ladies, I'll support you. I'm like a high school teacher. I do really well, better than you think. And like doing the sugar daddy thing. So that's what she's after. And she really sort of has that narrative thrust in the song of finding a guy to support her. And Jane Russell's there as well. She sings in like everything she's in. It must have been in their contract or something. But one of the lines is, I wanted to be wined and dined and ermined. And I don't know that there's anyone out there right now under the age of like 60 who is going to know the ermine reference. But I like that they take ermine, like the fur, and that you could have that back then. It's probably like all wrong now, and like you go to political correct jail. But they turned it into a verb, wined and dined, yes. Ermine, like outfitted in this stuff. That's just such a witty, tart line.
And it's a fun song. And I think you're right about Marilyn Monroe, who I think also is often underrated, especially early in her career, had some terrific performances, but she gets a chance to shine and show a different side of her personality in that, with that that intellect and that wit that wasn't always present in some of the roles that she had to play.
I never really think acting is just kind of this overrated thing. Like, I never watch something sometimes, but rarely do I think, oh, they're just terrible. Because when we're out in life with people, they're acting all the time, too. And it's not like they're master actors. Like, very few people are authentic. They're always doing some version of a character. So, like, if I watch Friends and Chandler's on there, like, I'm sure he's just whatever. But I never thought, oh, I'm not believing Chandler's motivation today with Monica. That rarely happens, I think, when I watch them. There are certain people who fill a role, like Mitchum, for instance, in Out of the Past, but I think Marilyn Monroe, she was always fine. It was more the part that she had to work with, and that was going to determine sort of the value of her performance. This is a good part. This is a Howard Hawks film, and it might seem like a strange Howard Hawks film doing musicals, but Howard Hawks, again, it's another example of how versatile he was as a director. You have the sci-fi of The Thing, and that was like not too many years away from this, but it's just a couple years, really. And you have Westerns, obviously, and war films, and aviation, and films, and all of that. So it was his sort of turn at the musical, and I think it was just perfect character for her. But this song, to me, is always one of the highlights of when I watch a film and it's like it's time for the music to start, and you get kind of that like Jane Russell contractual stipulation, it's like sex scenes and weddings. I don't need them. Like, they rarely ever work. You know, like, do you ever watch like a wedding scene or anything like, oh, I'm still like moved? It's just like, can we get hurry up movie? Can we get through this? But this is one of those musical performances where I'm all in.
Let's talk about another musical performance from a different time. Cream, captured live at the Revolution Club in 1968.
Now, did you like this? Because I know a guy like you, we've been down this road before. You're like, oh, I don't like hard rock. I like the sweet, soft rock stylings of Air Supply and Bread and the likes of them and Captain and Tennille. And I'm like, oh, God, this guy, Kimball, this port cider, what am I going to do with this guy? So I thought I'd maybe meet some resistance here. But having said that, I like to fast forward through weddings and everything. Normally, I have no interest in filmed rock and roll performances. I'm just more interested in the sound. Like, if it's on YouTube, I'm not disappointed when it's just like the music and like there's a still of the Beatles. I don't even really need to see the Beatles doing their thing. I'm more interested in sound. But having said that, viscerally and cinematically, this is a humdinger of a three-song performance from January 1968, because I would not have expected Cream, the members of Cream, to move like they do, like Jack Bruce. You can't stop looking at Jack Bruce during these three songs.
I felt like I was watching Spinal Tap. I thought, very, very close to self-parody.
Who makes you say that?
I just, the outfits, again, everybody was wearing them. I get it, but I don't know. Spoonful, I was laughing at it. I just found it to be very derivative. I don't know. Silly Brits doing what they do. And to me, Clapton's one of the most overrated people in rock history.
See, I don't know about either of those things. In fact, I would say that regarding Clapton, the problem with him is he stops innovating after about this year, 1968.
Yeah.
But during 66 to 68, which is, I mean, how many years do you need? Do you need him to be good in 1977? But if you look at from 66 to 68, it's one of the most innovative performers ever to play the guitar. And you have one of the best bassists, and you have one of the best drummers. And I think this is incredibly exciting, the way that these guys are playing and revamping the blues. Like, if you know the original version of Spoonful, I'm not, like, totally sure how one could get from... It's nothing like what they play. It's, like, such an overhauling of what Spoonful was, or any of the songs. And here they do Sunshine of Your Love is another one. But I think it's just very visceral, very exciting. And, yes, Jack Bruce has this, what would you even call his hat? It looks like he's wearing a muffler on his head that he stole off of Nanook of the North.
Yeah, he was Fess Parker, I thought, for a moment there.
Yeah, he has some sort of, like, creature of the woodlands. And I haven't seen that hat in a while. That hat, like, features in promo photos, how into Cream I am, from 1966. So when I first saw this, like, years ago, I thought it's Cream in 66. But to me, they were a band that came along, and we've spoken about this before. They were, like, who you were really into as the cutting-edge sort of band. They had this giant following on Facebook. Like, I'm really into them. But it's surprising to me how obsessed people become with Cream, but obviously not you there.
Well, and, you know, maybe if it may go back to childhood, too, when the cool kids, and again, what was I, 10? But, you know, the cool kids were talking about Disraeli Gears, and I was saying, did you watch The Monkees last night? So that tells you a little bit right there.
No, you can have both. I mean, The Monkees were a great pop band, certainly, and you can listen to Monkees live recordings from 1967, all of that. You get all these soundboards, and it's quite a contrast. But one thing I'd say about Cream is you just have three guys, and they're creating a symphonic roar. Like, a band like Cream could paste a band like Led Zeppelin. Listen to Led Zeppelin live when you get a chance, not in the studio where they're overdubbing 27 different guitar tracks. Listen to how just porous their sound is live. They cannot fill up the space that Cream does. Cream creates this wall of sound, and this is one of the great sort of high fidelity examples of that wall of sound. You could put out these three tracks and you'd have, I think, one of the best live albums of the 1960s, but compared with, like, Zeppelin, you're getting this sort of, like, light sound that has all of these holes in it and feels like it's just bobbing on top of the water, whereas there's something granitic but also flexible about Cream.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Well, let's go in a different direction here and talk about a very interesting short piece of writing. I hope I pronounced the name right, from the 1930s by, is it Daniil Carms, An Unexpected Drinking Bout?
Sure, yes. He was a Soviet writer of, I'm going to say the avant-garde, but people out there, it's like black and white for the kids with the TVs. For the films, when you say avant-garde to people, they go, oh no, I don't want that nonsense. It's almost, for lack of a better term, because it is whimsical and funny, and he did a lot with not many words. And I bet you were, had you read this before? I bet you were probably pretty entertained.
I had not read it before, and it was laugh out loud funny. And then I went back and read it a second time and laughed even louder. It was a brilliant piece.
Yeah, this guy had a bad life. He was persecuted, and his work wasn't published. But now, like, some sham place like the New Yorker will find something of his. And it's not like they ever would have, like, considered it when he was alive, if their times overlapped, and slap it up in their pages. But his papers were almost lost. Like, some guy had to risk his life after Carms was dead to go, like, find a trunk that had writings like this in it. And it's a very bawdy, B-A-W-D-Y story of lasciviousness and drunkenness and people drinking because their lives are so bereft of anything else. The drinking as the foreshadowing, drinking as an activity. And it's a story of infidelity and someone hiding in a trunk and it's like sort of like dirty, a couple ways over, unwashed and also like, hey there, dirty type of woman and just really kind of wanting to get your drink on.
And an immortal line that I will carry with me as he writes, it cannot be called hygienic if a naked young woman is sitting on the very table at which people are eating? Those are words to live by.
I would say that they're words to test Kimball's far. You can prove that theorem because, I don't know, one man's dirt is another man's butt. We are on the AM dial, and we must keep these things clean. We're not podcasters, Kimball.
No.
We do that.
But it was wonderful.
We'll cut loose. But yes, it is the type of thing that, like, if you don't have a sense of humor, you're starchy. You'd be like, oh, this is very low class. I do not like this. But Daniel Carms was smarter than the people who are going to brand him with that label. There is an energy, and there is a verb, and there is a command that he establishes right away. He's somebody who knows what he's doing. Now, he's out there, but when you go out there, if you know where you're standing, even if no one's gone to where you're at previously, you're going to come across as, like, definitive. And that's certainly what Carms did, but it's a kind of daring do in writing that people, first of all, they wouldn't have the imagination to come up with this, but they certainly wouldn't have the confidence. You need a lot of confidence to write a short story like this. It's all of a page.
Yeah, it was great. And it reminded me of much of your work, the ability to introduce characters and feel like we know them thoroughly in a very limited number of words.
And he animates it. Just like 12 Angry Men is animated, the guys walk around and there's a sort of flux to everything. Think of how much movement there is in this particular short piece. It's very difficult to do physical comedy in prose. I mean, think of, like, examples of that. Like, you don't really have that. You have it, like, in film with Buster Keaton or Charlie Chaplin or whatever, but you don't have a lot of physical comedy, and there's a lot of verbal daring do in this, and verbal comedy and wordplay and a certain, like, piquant raunchiness, but you also have a lot of movement and sleight of hand and people popping out of here and popping into this, and there's a lot, it's like a symphony of movement in addition to all of the language.
It is wonderful, and it leads us into our last topic today, and that is recognizing that Sunday for you marked 5 years without a drink, and you have been upfront about saying it's not 5 years of sobriety. What is it about that distinction?
Well, that's the catch-all, like, line that people use, like, how long have you been sober? People will say that, and they ask that question, and they talk about their own sobriety. It's just what people say, and it's like the official term. But for a lot of years, I drank, and I wrote about this on the blog. I mean, there's, in some ways, this, it's nothing that I've never not been open about. I've always put this out there. I haven't withheld anything. But for a lot of years, I drank probably 20 or 30 units of alcohol a day. And a unit is like a beer or a glass of wine or an ounce of whiskey, like a shot. So it really adds up to quite a bit. And I never became inebriate, though. I was always, like, in complete control of my faculties and all of that stuff, which is actually in many ways worse, because what ends up happening is you're getting all of the negative effects for your body. It's still obviously doing to your liver what it's doing to your liver, and in my case, doing to my heart what it was doing to my heart. It gave myself an irregular heartbeat. So I was always careful, though, never to talk about, like, it's been 200 and however many weeks of sobriety. At the same time, like, when I mentioned to you the other day, like, we should talk about this, and I said to you that if I make it to Sunday. And the reason I did that, because I've always, like, used this since I've started doing it as a way to keep myself in control of what I can control in the moment. Like, I never want to presume that the next day that I haven't reached yet is going to be the day that this is official. I always say to myself, earn the day, especially at this very difficult time in my life. Earn the day. Earn the story. Don't just, like, have the story you're going to write. Earn the story. Talk about it then. So that was something that I did. And I was never, like I said, I was never, like, drunk or sending out, like, crazy things to publishers. And part of the reason, too, was, like I said in the blog, that with the things that I have to do and the war I'm in, I didn't want anybody to be able to level a charge that he only did this. He only split my head open on his blog because he was drunk. No, I was limpid-eyed, and I was split in the open then.
But you shared a couple of photos, one from, I believe it was 8 years ago. And it's striking to me in looking at that. And again, you were not a fallen down, drunk, the life of the party kind of thing. You were what we sometimes will call a functioning drinker. But you look so much younger today. Obviously, doing the right thing for your body makes a difference, because you look 10 years younger in pictures now than you did 8 years ago.
I would say, in like that photo, that was at Durgan Park, that one from 2013. And like when I went out, I was not drinking copious amounts. I was doing the copious drinking in private, and it would start earlier and earlier. Like it could be 2 p.m. And so it was obviously, and I mean, I have no life. I have no friends. People read the blog or have listened to a few of these segments have sort of picked up on some of the themes. And it was something to do. It was an activity. But like if I had to go somewhere, the rare times that I did travel, it's not like I was shaking and I had to have the drinks and whatnot, but I was just socking away so much. And the way I handled this was I said, okay, drink as much as you want. It was a Saturday. As you want, drink whatever you want until 11:59. And tomorrow starts a new week, and you're going to start a streak. And that's what I did. And I found that a lot of people, like, for instance, you're one of only two people that I know who said anything to me about this, which speaks in many ways to how people feel about me, which is obviously, it's not good. I mean, friends, family, all that, whatever. No one said anything. I mean, you were the first one. And we've never met in person. So a lot of people resented it, too, I learned. And so that has been difficult. But within a few days of stopping drinking, my face, I could tell. Like, it was that, like, for people out there, you want to see, like, an immediate gain if you are maybe drinking too much. It tells in the face, like, straight away. And then I got competitive. I got into it. I was like this sort of like mini Cal Ripken, and I like looking better.
Do you miss it at all?
That's an interesting question. No one's ever asked me that. Like, I thought I would miss, like, beer, and I didn't. I could easily never have a desire for beer again, but something like quality Scotch whiskey, like Lafroig or Ardbeg or Lagavulin or something like that. When I think of where I want to be and like the windlash coast and everything and the rainy day and having the dram of whiskey, like conceptually that has great appeal to me, but the peace of mind, like I could, this will sound strange because you'd think like that's not possible. I could be someone who had the one drink of whiskey a day or a week or whatever it was. It wouldn't be like, oh no, I'm back in my cups again. I went to bars and I read in bars and drank cranberry juice. It gives me such peace of mind though. And I'm a hypochondriac, but it gives me such peace of mind knowing that there's no alcohol in my system and that I have control of that. So like if you're walking as much as I walk and running stairs and you don't drink alcohol, like really, what's the worst that can happen? And you know my life, like the stress of my life probably causes stress in your own life. And you can only imagine what it's like living this way. So I had to take that into account. And also I have an industry to take down and I'm not losing to these bigoted people.
Well, congratulations on 5 years and 2 days and many more ahead, we trust. Colin, good to talk with you. As always, my friend, and we'll visit again next Tuesday.
Okay, Port Sider.
Colin Fleming on Downtown. Visit his website, ColinFlemingLit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. Get your hands on Meatheads Say the Realest Things.